Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast, a conversation in the martial arts focusing on Kenpo and its practitioners and our journey in the art. I am Reggie Darden, and today my guest is Master Paul Dai. So we're just going to, you know, jump right in and hear a story about Kenpo and whatever else we happen to come across. So yeah, if you could just fill us in on, you know, how did Kenpo find you and what was your journey in the martial arts and in Kenpo, and where did it all start for you?
Sure. My journey was started in 1972. It was on a college campus in Walnut, California. There was a Kenpo club on campus. I didn't per se, I guess, want to get into it myself. It was sort of accidental. Kind of walked a girl over to where the club was going to take place. And one thing led to another. And next thing you know, I'm in the gym. It was actually a wrestling gym. The instructor kind of yanked me, threw me on the floor and said, "Here's what you're going to do." It's like, okay. And then that's kind of how it started. The reason for the club on campus was 1972 was the kind of the height of the Bruce Lee movement. So, of course, the martial art world, at least out here in California, was massively intense. The club was from a school in Glendora, California, which was about 10 miles away. That particular studio owner had one of his students attending the college. So, of course, he told that person to start a club on campus. And, you know, that's kind of how that started. Within a few weeks, the fellow who owned the studio wanted me to go actually to the studio. And he invited me to go. So I went, not really knowing what to expect. And then it was within a day or so, he goes, "You're going to jump in the class at the studio." It's like, okay, and jumped in the studio. And then his, I guess you would say my instructor, who was Jim Thompson, he started me right away within a day or so. And I was kind of hooked on the teachings. I definitely liked the way he taught. And then, of course, it was interesting for sure. In those days, roughness was the word. So it was very, very rough on the body. The hits were enormous, which was fun. It was okay. And then within probably inside a month, Mr. Thompson was teaching me how to teach. So they gave me my first group of students within probably 2 months of training. But my training was a lot different. It was truly 12 hours a day, nonstop, just enough for water to keep going. I was very blessed to have a teacher like that. He never rested at all. So in the morning at 9 o'clock, we started. He was teaching me curriculum, the curriculum itself. Then he was teaching me how to teach it to a student, which is actually a little different. So I got kind of best of both worlds. Within inside a year, about a year or so, the studio was going to close. The fellow who owned the studio was going to bodyguard for Elvis Presley. He took that job, and then the studio, obviously, it closed. And at the time, I thought, I'm comfortable, I'm good, I'm just going to go back to the sports that I was playing at the time. And then a couple students from the studio, they found out where I lived. And then they were actually juveniles. I was 18. They were 13. They rode their bikes to our house and then asked if they, you know, could continue their learnings under me. The first couple days, it's like, no, I'm good. I'm okay. And then they kept riding their bikes back. And that was a journey. I was about probably 8 miles one way on a bicycle. And then on day three or day four, it's like, I went to close the door and the kid stuck his foot in the door. I said, what are you doing? He goes, well, he goes, you're our teacher. He goes, where else would I learn? It's like, it was really a profound thing. It ended up being a really important thing. So I said, okay, tomorrow after your school, you come over. And him and a friend actually came over. And that's actually how my teachings at home started. That was 1973. And I've taught at my home ever since that day. You know, I never had a commercial school. That's kind of how the journey started. And for the next 50 years, very active, taught nonstop, not 5 days a week, 2 to 3 days a week, very close-knit group. I really don't take anybody new unless they know somebody that's already here. So, you know, my student base has always been, I guess you would say, on the small side, more of a tight-knit family group.
Okay.
That's kind of how it all started.
Gotcha. Let's kind of go back to your start. The lady that you were with, she was already a student in the club, or this was something?
No, she was actually, we were in a curriculum class, just a classroom, and she had heard that there was going to be a martial arts club start, keeping in mind that at the time, a lot of people were interested in seeing it because of what they were seeing at the movie houses, actually, what is it? Mm-hmm. And television. Mm-hmm. And it was dark. It was nighttime. She goes, can you walk me over? It's like, I had no interest in going over, but, you know, I guess parents always taught me, it's like, if a girl needs help, you help her. So, mm-hmm. You know, I walked her across the campus, and the first night, actually, there was nobody in the room. And then she asked one more time. I said, I'll just do it one more time. I'll walk you over. And I walked over, and then the door was open to the gym. And then I didn't want her walking in because I didn't know who was in there. I actually poked my head in, and Mr. Thompson actually grabbed me by the shirt and threw me in there. He goes, you're taking karate right now. It's like, I was kind of actually scared. He was a scary looking guy. He goes, you stand right there. You're starting right now. The girl that asked me to go, she ran away. It was pretty scary. It was scary. Yeah, she took off.
I don't
blame her because it was frightening. And then within like a minute or two, it's like 90 seconds, and nobody else showed up. I was it. I'm the only guy. And he had me in, you know, the traditional horse stance, and then he told me to stick out my arm, so I stuck out my arm straight, and then he snapped it, kind of like, you know, an anti-joint sprain thing, and I went right to the ground in pain. It hurt. And it's like, wow. Like, he goes, go ahead and stand up. So I stood up. I was terrified. So I stood up. He goes, how'd that feel? I go, it hurt. He goes, it's supposed to hurt. It's like, and yeah, I'm hooked. It's like, how'd you do that? I want to do that. It was more curious, I guess. Like, yeah, I want to do that. But yeah, the poor little girl, she took off. I'm out.
Did she ever come back, or did she ever train at all or anything as far as you know?
Nope. Matter of fact, in the subsequent classroom stuff, she never said a word. She never said anything.
That's wild. So, what do you think attracted you to it? Because I mean that first experience certainly would scare off most people. But what do you think made you stick with?
I think it was the curiosity of how it worked. Like how does that work? How did that happen? And then, you know, Mr. Thompson, the fellow who taught me, he was definitely unique. Not like the average karate teacher, per se. A very, very fascinating martial artist. So I think my curiosity excited him, and we kind of fed off each other. And then each time he would move, he would hurt me. I mean, it was not like today's martial arts. You really the students don't want to be hurt. You don't hit them. And he hit, and actually it hurt, but it was really like curious, like, how does that happen? And then I think he realized that I was maybe not the normal student. It's like, I'm in it. I mean, I'm good to go. So as long as you want to stand there, I will stand in front of you and learn. Like, there's no half hour lesson. It's like, you know, once he kind of understood that, then they invited me to the studio and away we went. The club at the campus never was very large. There's at the most maybe 10 to 20. A couple of us went from the college to the studio. There was two of us. And we still practice today. He's, Mr. Rainey's in a different state. I'm in California, but that's how we both got our start, was at the school.
Okay. And the lineage of your teacher, who did he train under and kind of what was that background?
Jim Thompson was student of a fellow named Jim Grunwald. Jim Grunwald was first generation Ed Parker black belt from the studio in Pasadena. And then Mr. Thompson became the studio manager for Dave Hebler. Dave Hebler was the gentleman that owned the studio, and he was the gentleman that went to bodyguard with Elvis. So Mr. Thompson's ranking came from Mr. Grunwald first, and then Mr. Hebler second. And understanding in those days, when you got your ranking, it was actually from Mr. Parker. He was the one presenting you or elevating you in rank. And in those days, there wasn't a lot of rank like there is nowadays. Mm-hmm. Mr. Hebler was a seventh, which was the highest at the time. We're talking 72, 73. Mr. Thompson was actually already a fourth black. And in those days, if you saw four tips on a belt, it was something to look at for sure. Mm-hmm. 50 years later, then of course there's a lot of red on the belts, and it's maybe not quite as all struck looking as it was in those days.
Yeah. So going back, so, you know, you started teaching, pretty early in your journey. Was that something that you wanted to do, or you showed a desire for, or was it that something that just was kind of thrust upon you, or?
Definitely not. It wasn't thrust upon. I think I had definitely the want to do it, because it was fun. Doing karate was fun. Passing on the physicality was fun, and the information was fun. And then, of course, there was a lot of students at the studio, so it was a pretty exciting time. To give you an example, karate schools now, I don't know what student bases are, but at that time, there were 470 students enrolled at that school. So karate was, at a high point for sure. And then I had some juvenile students that were, at the time, I guess you would say, kind of important, because even though they were 12 to 14 years old, they looked up to you as their teacher. It was like a responsibility. It kind of went beyond the punch kick. It was more as either a real good friend or a second dad or something like that. And of course, I was only 18, but it was an important thing. So, yeah, it was kind of meant to be, I guess.
Gotcha. And so you mentioned that, you didn't have a typical, commercial school, or is that something you ever, had desire to do, or just happened that you didn't seek out a formal formal school per se.
Yeah, I never had the desire to go the commercial route. I guess you would say, I was fortunate enough to get married at 20 years old. And then, of course, we had a family kind of right away. And commercial schools is not a guaranteed income. And there's no guaranteed insurance and those, all of those type of things. I wanted to make sure that, you know, I had a regular job with insurance that would cover the kids and all of those things. And then I don't know about the rest of the United States, but in Southern California, because of the explosion, there was money to be made for sure in commercial school. But by 74, 75, there were enough guys teaching karate that the word got out that some of them were crooks. And it made the newspapers, meaning there wasn't internet or anything like that. The only media was in print. And some of the newspapers started running articles about, you might not want to go to karate school because a lot of them are, they're bogus. And that was also another reason why I didn't want to get into it, because I didn't want to get into that type of, you know, a business that would decline. It's like, I want to just make sure I'm, you know, comfortable with income and insurance. But that being said, I was already teaching at home. Like I already had students here. So it's not like I had to open up to get students. They were already here. So yeah, it all kind of worked out okay, but never a desire. I had the studio to go to, Mr. Parker's studio in Pasadena. Went there once a week for probably 16 years. So, I mean, always had a studio to go to, but not open up one for myself.
Okay, great. And so, you know, as you're coming up, did you do any, you know, competing or anything like that? Any kind of tournaments or?
Yeah, we, in the mid seven tournament scene in Southern California was definitely large because of the popularity of the martial arts. There were tournaments once a week everywhere. So, you know, we did the competitive thing and then, you know, the officiating stuff for years and years and years. Then, you know, for me, it just got to the point after, you know, 15 to 20 years going to a tournament every Sunday. It's like, I want my weekends back. You know, I'm kind of okay, you know. You know, competitive wise, yeah, we competed and, you know, we did the first place stuff and the grand championship stuff and, you know, all of those things, which is fun and it's good. You know, it is definitely not a necessity, but I think in sport, it's just, you know, like I'll have students ask or inquire. It's like, it's not so much the win-loss. It's just, you know, like any sport, like if you're going to jump into baseball, football, or whatever, it's like, if you're going to jump into competition, it's just another avenue to learn things. Like, how do you prepare? How do you deal with the anxiety? You know, all of those type of sport related things. Mm-hmm. You know, competition was, you know, those type of things. And of course, then you officiate and, you know, we did that everywhere. And then we ended up, you know, competing in different states. And then in the later years, you know, you're asked to officiate, you know, all the black belt divisions and all of those things. And yeah, paid our dues and did all that.
Good. Yeah. Now, was that in sparring or did you do forms or other divisions as well? Or
I fought and then forms and then self-defense. It was kind of my favorite was the self-defense. The self-defense, I was telling Peter that, you know, me and Patty, my wife, we were actually at Long Beach at IKC I think it was 82 or 83. We officiated all day, and we were out in the parking lot in Long Beach outside of the arena. And Mr. Parker was walking by. He goes, "Can I see you a minute?" "Yeah, sure. What's up?" And he goes, "I have a favor." I said, "What is it?" He goes, "Next year, I want to have a competition that nobody's seen before." It's like, I go, "What do you have in mind?" He goes, "Well, you know, Kempu, we have, you know, we do self-defense application, the technique thing." I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I want to make it a competition." It's like, "Okay." I go, "What do you got in mind?" He goes, We need a competition where competitors can do a punch, a kick, and a grab, execute self-defense application, be judged on it, where it's part of a tournament." It's like, "Yeah, okay." And he just looked at me right in the face. He goes, "I want you to make it work." He goes, "You enter and make it work." It's like, wow. At the time, standing in front of him, I mean, me and Patty knew how serious he was. He wasn't joking. I mean, he wanted it to work. It had never been done before. So it's like, he was serious. And definitely not going to let him down. So we took 10 months and choreographed 3 sets of material and entered the following year. And then my career, I was 67-0, never got beat. And, you know, each time, you know, I went to compete, I always saw him in the back of my mind standing there. It's like, yeah, we'll make it work. And it's not going away. It's going to last. And then there's still self-defense divisions today. So, yeah.
Very nice.
Very cool.
Very nice. So now, your wife also trains? Did she?
Yeah. Her career was a little later. The way our lives kind of, you know, how it was, you know, we had 2 girls, and then I kind of worked a day shift. She worked a swing shift, which kind of alleviated a lot of the babysitter scenario. Hmm. But once my girls were in junior high, she always wanted to be educator. So once girls went junior high, she went back to school to get the degrees, which of course takes, you know, a set of years. After the master's, being so busy for 8 to 10 years doing schoolwork, there was idle time. I thought, well, you know, if there's idle time, maybe she can come out to the garage and start her journey. So, you know, she came out to the garage and started her journey. And then she kind of, the way it kind of worked out is, anybody that knows her, she is the gentle flower out of all of us thugs. I mean, she's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the time in the garage, I really had a thugster. I mean, he was a rough house, no question, bar fighting type of guy, but he was the non-flower, right? He was the cactus guy. So the way it worked out, their journeys were kind of started out at the same time. So they went through the ranks together, and it was a really cool thing because, you know, Ron needed he needed grace and beauty, and she provided that. And then his roughness, I mean, you know, his training and the weightlifting and the fighting, she needed that. Mm-hmm. So it actually was really cool. And of course, they went all the way from yellow to black, all the way through third black, you know, together, mm-hmm. which was made a really cool thing. And then, you know, she's, I don't know, in the Kempo community, she's one of the female leaders for sure. If her journey would have started like when mine did, there'd be no question. To give you an idea, in the college days before she started her training, she would be at the Pasadena studio. And then when Mr. Parker would come in, they would sit down and talk. But not about martial arts. They would talk about different things. So There was actually a bond between Patty and Mr. Parker even before her journey even started. But, you know, sadly with the passing, when he passed, you know, he never got to see her do her thing, which is kind of too bad. Yeah, but yeah, she's been with me the whole time, the whole journey. She's been right with me.
Very cool. Very cool. So going back to when you got your first black, when was that? And maybe can you kind of talk about how that all.
Yeah. First black was fall, about this time period in 1974. It took place at Mr. Parker's school on Walnut Avenue in Pasadena. And I guess the procedure was a little different back then compared to now, but back at that time period, you were supposed to have your teacher present at your belt test. We didn't have one. He was gone. So both Mr. Hebler was gone and Mr. Thompson was gone. They took different jobs. They weren't around. I just thought, now's the time. So Mr. Rainey was actually living with me and Patty. And it was a Saturday morning. I asked, look at AC. I say, it's time to go get black belt right now. He goes, what are you talking about? I go, right now. Let's go. It was at 1 o'clock. This was 11 o'clock. He goes, we can't. We don't have a teacher there. I go, I'm your teacher. You're my teacher. So let's go. So we went. Of course, testing board was not nearly as large as they are now because there really wasn't that many black belts. You know, you had a few there. And in those days, it really was the 3-hour belt test. I mean, it was hard, you know, hard things. Mr. Parker right in the center as usual. It was pretty cool. I had my first brown belt standing right behind me. So he was wearing green going to brown. I was brown going to black. Right there, right behind me. So that was a really cool thing to have. And then, yeah.
Yeah, so the testing was already scheduled, but I guess I'm not understanding, like, did you already have a, you know, a discussion about testing beforehand or it was just like, okay, there's going to be testing today, and then whoever shows up to test, that's how it goes? Or,
well, it's supposed to be that way, right? So it's supposed to be all set up and ready to go, but no, we didn't have anybody. I just walked in and said, I'm testing. And then, of course, there were a few senior ranks that said, no, you're not, get out. It's like, it's not happening. Mm-hmm. No. We're here. We're good. You know, start. So it was different for sure. I've never seen anything like it. It's like, it was pretty crazy.
And did you have to like plead your case, or they just said, oh, well, he's here. Let's just do it.
Well, there was, yeah, it wasn't so much pleading, but there were a couple guys, meaning seniors, that wanted us to leave, I guess you would say, in a polite fashion. So I just kind of moved them out of the way. I just moved them out of the way. I just looked at Mr. Parker. I go, we good? He goes, we're good. And away we went. That's kind of how it actually went.
Excellent. I like that. That sounds very, very nerve-wracking. So it's interesting that, you know, kind of stuck to your guns and went through it. I think being faced with a panel of senior folks, I would, I'm not sure I would jump at the chance to be like, well, you know, you may not want me here, but, you know, I'm going to be here anyway. Like, kind of just turn around and, okay, maybe I'll come back when you guys aren't here. Somebody else
is pretty crazy. Is here. Fun though.
Very nice. Very nice. So do you have any particular situations or stories that kind of stand out in your mind that you'd like to share? Maybe any particular time with Ed Parker or just any kind of standout moments in your training that maybe wanted to share?
Well, I think, you know, in hindsight, you know, any time you're with me, really don't know what the phrase is. You would have just had to have known him, I guess. You know, people have asked over the years, you know, I guess there's the only way to really explain his presence of him, like the aura, was, you know, me and Patty were fortunate enough to meet Elvis and, you know, be in that environment. And like, for example, you know, being in the penthouse with Elvis and the entourage and stuff, when he would walk in, you couldn't really take your eyes off of him. You could talk to somebody else over here, but you're looking over there kind of thing. Mr. Parker had that thing. So it wasn't so much what he said, what he did. It was just the presence of him, right? And all those are unique, whether they were laughing moments, restaurant moments, belt testing, classes. You know, in hindsight, you wish you had them all back because we always thought he would be there forever, you know, type thing. But, you know, I miss the lessons. I miss his voice, actually. A very unique talking and speaking voice and the way he would deliver lessons and classes. Kind of miss that a lot. He's a joke teller. I kind of miss that. You know, the ukulele playing, you know, that side. You know, he's serious and funny, just like everybody else. But it's just, there's so many, you can't really isolate it down. I do know doing the self-defense for him when he asked for me, it was important because we knew how important it was just by the way he looked at us when he asked. It's like, yeah, I'll make it happen. You know, make it work. But yeah. You know, was kind of, you know, most of us have actually taught way longer than he taught. That's how much time has gone by. It's you know, he only taught for, you know, 20, 29, 30 years, and we've taught for 50.
Yeah.
You know, we're kind of at the point now where some people don't even know who he is just because time is moving by. It's real important for me. It, you know, I have his picture obviously in the garage. Usually I'll try and mention his name once a night, so people kind of have an understanding where we came from.
Yeah, exactly. So, exactly. Yeah. In my school, that's part of the testing requirements is to have, you know, facts about Ed Parker so that, you know, we do, you know, keep this art that, you know, that he provided for us, you know, in the forefronts of our minds, and knowing who he is definitely an important part of that. So
that's good. That's good.
Yeah. I definitely, you know, and that's kind of one of the reasons why, you know, I'm trying to do this podcast is to, you know, get that, those stories out there and get, you know, keep part of that legacy alive. So yeah, it's really important to, you know, speak with people that, you know, have trained with him and been around him and can, you know, share those things with him.
Yeah. I'll give you a couple stories. Maybe you understand maybe what he was like as a person rather than, you know, I guess, let's say our grandmaster per se, right? So is there the Infinite Insight book up there, the original one? He came out with, you know, the Infinite Insight books when they were getting ready to be released. It was pretty exciting time because there hadn't really been anything like it. And we had had the Big Red Book, you know, which was a major project for him, but it wasn't so much in literature form, I guess you would per se. And then he had told us he'd been working on the Infinite Insight books and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, they were going to be made and, you know, yada, yada. It's like, great. So we got the first books, we were probably the first or second people to get our hands on the book. And then I was at Pasadena at the studio. I just got the book. He came in. So, of course, I want him to sign the book. Like, yeah, can you sign my book? He goes, of course, I'll sign your book. We were actually on the mat working out. Mm-hmm. So I just gave him the book. I just flipped him the book. I go, I'll get it when we're done working out. He goes, fine. It'll be in the office. So we, you know, we're doing our thing, you know, smacking the you-know-what out of each other. And then we're done. We changed. So I was like, he took off. So I want to go get my book and see what kind of cool things he said about me in the book. Like, you know, like everybody's like, I want to see what he says. Well, here's what he said. He signed it to my daughters.
There you go. Yeah.
Right. So what it says is to Jenny and Lisa, success in life, Ed Parker. So that might give you an idea what he was really like. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So big tough guy, right? He signs it to, at the time, the girls were probably 3 and 5. Mm-hmm. But he saw them once a week at the studio. So he signs my book, not to me, but to my girls, right? Yeah. So it kind of gives you maybe a little different insight as to, you know, who he was and what he was like. Because it's, Reggie, the hardest thing to do. Like, if me and Patty were to ask you about, let's say, your father. Mm-hmm. What happens is we state facts. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you ask me about my dad, well, you know, my dad was born in Indiana. He was born in 1908. You know, he fought Rommel in World War II in Africa. Mm-hmm. You know, he liked, you know, nitro burning airplanes. But the reality is those are just facts. It doesn't tell you about the personality of my father. Right?
Exactly.
In trying to teach, especially black belt classes in the 90s and the early 00s when I was traveling a lot, I was trying to build lessons for those fellows and girls. And at the end of the lesson, try and give them aspect of Mr. Parker's personality that they can actually get from karate. Like, here's a lesson. Yes, it is karate. But at the end, I want you to be able to understand what he was like as a person. And those lessons, I mean, it took me like a year to try and put those together because I wanted them to understand him as a person, not just the karate guy. Because karate's just a little part of all of our lives. We're all, mm-hmm. you know, unique people. But usually when you talk about Ed Parker, you're just hearing facts. Is facts. This with the book, it kind of gives you, it's like a little different insight as to, you know, what he was like. Another little story to give you an idea. We were working out at Pasadena, and then he came in the studio, and then he doesn't suit up, he doesn't go in the office. He actually ends up sitting with Patty on the bench by the catwalk. Pasadena studio had a catwalk with a bench. Mm-hmm. Of course, when he's there and he's sitting there, you're going to do the best karate you can do because you're trying to show off for the guy, right? I mean, you're doing your thing. Okay. So we work out for 2 hours and then, you know, class is over, we close up and then we change and then he takes off. And then, you know, me and Patty jump in the car to come back home. So in the car, I'm saying, okay, so what cool things did he say about me? I mean, he had to like my karate. He's like, did he like this? Did he like that? And she's like looking at me. It's like, I go, well, what are you looking at? She goes, we didn't talk about karate. It's like, mm-hmm. what are you talking about? I mean, we beat ourselves to a pulp trying to impress this guy, right? It's like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I go, you didn't talk about karate at all. It's like, you sat there for 90 minutes. She goes, no. I go, what'd you talk about for an hour and a half? Well, you know, we talked about the girls you know, in their first grade in kindergarten. And then he asked me how my college was going. So we were talking about college and this and that. I go, you never talked about karate once. She goes, nope, not one time. So that will kind of give you an idea. You know, we're sitting there blasting away, not more than 10 feet from him. And then he's talking to my wife about children, kindergarten, and college. So there you go.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I like that. You know, you hit the nail on the head perfectly about just spouting off, you know, facts versus, you know, knowing the actual person and what they were like. I'm a big, you know, I'm still in the process of reading Lee Wedlake's book, who I will be chatting with actually the end of this week. But I'm really enjoying his book, Lessons with Ed Parker, because it gives you a sense of what it was like to be with him and the kind of person that he was, versus just spouting off, oh yeah, he did this then, and he did this here, and he said this. Like, okay, you know, yeah, that's the facts, but what was it like actually being with him and being around him and you know, getting inspired by him? And I really enjoy that book really gives you a sense of that. And you know, as you said, you know, as time is going on and people are less and less familiar with him, having these kind of personal records to go along with it, you know, can give, you know, the future generations a sense of what it's like, you know, what it was like to train with him, what it was like to know with him, and to know what kind of person he was. So, yeah, that's huge. So just a couple of things before we get into our kind of wrap up lightning round questions, so to speak. So your children, do they train also, or are they not?
They just trained for a little while. They're both very good. I guess in their life at the time, school was a big deal and they were roller skaters. So they were at the skate house every day doing the roller skating thing. But physically, they were both amazing. They were both tournament winners, just not quite as much in their blood as me and you, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I do Kenpo so that I don't have to roller skate. So. So then just kind of going over, you know, all the years that you've been teaching and whatnot, I'm kind of curious as to what your thoughts are about, you know, the, I don't know, I guess mindset or attitude towards learning the martial arts, getting a martial arts. So with the popularity of MMA and that sort of thing, just kind of what do you see as far as maybe the changes in the kind of students that you get or the mindset, and you know, where do you kind of see that heading? Where do you kind of see the future of Kenpo, and maybe where would you like to see it go? That it's, you know, that it's going based on your perspective, or maybe, you know, are there things that maybe we're not doing that you'd like to see come back, and maybe vice versa? Are there things that we didn't, you know, you didn't do in your early days that we do now that maybe wish, you know, was around at that time? And just kind of your overall kind of view of how things have changed.
Well, they've definitely changed, that's for sure. I think what we get out of it, if you look at it historically speaking, it's pretty straightforward. The public is definitely enamored with what we see on a screen. So what started the whole martial art craze in the first place was television with, you know, what we saw on television, and then the Bruce Lee type of films, and of course, Billy Jack and everything mm-hmm. else. You know, in that 1971 to 76 time frame, the public was definitely enamored by what they saw on a screen, for sure. So we know that led to a martial art craze. I mean, it was on Wide World of Sports.
Yeah.
You know, that show back in the day. The Battle of Atlanta. You know, they would telecast that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's popularity. And then when Mr. Speakman made Perfect Weapon, what we know is definitely there was a lot of curiosity towards Kempo itself because that's what was being portrayed on the screen. Okay, no question that, you know, movie adds curiosity. When MMA, you know, did its thing 18, 20 years ago, whatever it was, it takes people to what they see and what they hear. Ooh, it's MMA, so that's got to be the cool thing because it's what we see. It's a perception, right? So, you know, the martial art world kind of changed a little bit. If you were a professional studio owner, it was really hard not to have ground fighting because that's what the public wanted. So, you know, a lot of the guys had to incorporate ground fighting. It's not necessarily that they wanted to. You have to because that's your business. Like, you need to sell a product, right? So, you know, we're kind of in that phase. And like all history, we don't know what's going to happen. But something will happen. Like, something will change. Something will come along. And then it will take it a different direction. Whatever that direction's going to be. You know, for myself, at the age I am, you know, I'm comfortable just teaching, you know, Mr. Parker's art form. I don't, you know, it's like, I'm kind of good where I'm at, I guess you would say. You know, as far as practitioners from old days to new days, like, answer that kind of question. At least here, I don't know about everywhere else, but at the garage, generation and generation one and two, they were more here for fighting kind of thing. It was a rough place. There was no rules here. There's no rules. So, you know, we ended up with blood splatter on not only all the garage walls, even the ceiling. So it was a rough place. As the years kind of went a little further, the person who was really interested wasn't so much about getting cut faces and chipped teeth. And they were more here for just self-defense application, exercise, knowledge. So the student kind of changed a little bit. It's like just the desire of, you know, that's kind of where we're at now, I guess, as far as at least, you know, the people I run into. But something will happen. Some media will happen. Some sport will happen. MMA will change or something else will be popular. And it's just kind of how it goes.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, it's definitely changed, you know, a lot over the years. So yeah, I can see how that goes. So to kind of get in our kind of wrap up mode here, got a few questions here. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Favorite one? Not really. No. I mean, we have the normal oddballs that, you know, people don't really care for. We all have, you know, we got those, but no, they're all unique. They're all cool. They're all fun and interesting. You know, I'll do pretty much, you know, if you were standing right here, we just go right through it and just do them all. I'd have fun with all of them.
Oh, so. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Not so much. Everybody says five swords. It's like,
that's one of the Kempo all-stars, as I like to call it.
Right. It is a fascinating thing, though, when you look at it, because if it interests millions of people, it kind of gets down into, well, why is that? Like, what about it? It's like, you know, what is it that makes it where everybody likes it? You know, but it is a thing. We were just talking about it on Thursday, as a matter of fact. Like, the students were, you know, let's do five swords. It's like, dude, can you think of any other technique? Well, we like it. It's like, and that kind of led us into why. It's like, you know, is it because it's right hand dominant or who knows?
Yeah, that's one of the ones that I call the Kenpo All-Star, because so I started in essentially the Tracy's version of Kenpo, and now I'm under, you know, Ed Parker style. And techniques like five swords, thundering hammers, they exist in both versions, and I'm sure probably in other, you know, the other versions of Kenpo that exist out there. There are some techniques that you always seem to find in that. And so, yeah, I see those as the all-stars, and, you know, those are the ones that everybody brings up when they're talking about Kenpo or its offshoot. So, very nice. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Probably short three seems to be the most fun for me to do, only because just, I guess, the flow of the nature of it, you can do things with it that you can't do on the double-sided forms as easy. So you can throw in syncopation and beat counts, timing, you know, rhythm, power. You can kind of do all those in that form, and you can do it three or four times and make it look completely different each time. You know, just having fun per se, it would be like short three, I guess. Yeah.
Excellent. If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
Oh, I'd want my instructor back for sure. No question. Yeah. Jim Thompson, I would, you know, he's passed on, but if I could go back when we were younger, like, you know, like when I was, you know, 18 or so, and he was 40, you know, those were really fun times, both physically and intellectually. Was very fun, very hard person, no nonsense, hurt you every day. If you didn't like it, you left. You know, he's kind of one of those. Yeah. And then getting, not necessarily lessons from Ed Parker. I mean, everybody talks about the lessons and everything. Just being with them would be fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be cool. Did do some karate with Elvis a couple times. That was fun. You know, just because he's gone, like, it would be to have the times to do it again, because he's no longer with us. Then doing karate with all my students is still a blessing. Both my grandsons are, you know, black belts. Doing karate with them, you know, is fun. Performing with them is fun. They've done demos with me. They've competed with me. They're international champs themselves. And, you know, I still get to do that. They teach. It's like pretty blessed to have that, you know, situation here. But yeah, those four or five would be in the top notch for sure.
I like it. Sounds good. All right. And so for the final and the hardest question of them all. So in honor of Ed Parker's love for humor, do you have a joke that you'd like to share with us?
A joke? No, not per se. I can tell you, here's one for you. When I was traveling a lot, a question that would be asked was, what was it like to be taught by Ed Parker? At first, you're trying to give him whatever comes to your mind. But you can actually get taught by Ed Parker like we did. Meaning, one, I you know, everybody has a methodology of how you teach. It's like, how do you do it, right? So a lot of times in those earlier days, he would teach with incorporated humor, being you talked about a joke, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't so much a joke per se, but if you read through the books, right, you'll read about the Chinese fan, or you'll read about, you know, Lincoln in a phone booth, you know, those stories. That's actually the stories he told us. That is exactly where they come from. So if you're reading in print, let's say in Lee's book, he gives a lesson and he's talking about Ed Parker talking about the Chinese fan or, you know, Lincoln in a phone booth. When you absorb the stories in print, just understand that's how he taught us. Those, when we're standing there in our uniform, that's actually what he's saying. So understanding that, then you understood that, or you could understand that he incorporated a lot of humorous aspect to the lessons he was delivering to us, right? And what do we call those? You teach by
analogies.
Yeah. To how you teach. So, for example, if he was talking about the phone booth and Lincoln in a phone booth, right? The lesson of it. And of course, Mr. Parker was very funny. He's funny. He's funny in verbal. He was funny, his facial expressions. Very funny guy. Sometimes he's so funny. Sometimes I think the students miss the whole analogy. Because it'd be like listening to Robin Williams. Like, it's so fast and so funny, you're missing it. The lesson would be incorporated in that humor, in the humor. So, you know, that was one of his ways of, you know, delivering lessons. Not so much a joke, but definitely the humor. You kind of missed that because it was just a very unique way of delivering across your lessons. Like, you know, I use analogies all the time. Some humor, I really don't use his because they can get it from, they can find it if they want it. But yeah, it's a pretty funny guy.
I like it.
Pretty funny
guy.
All
right. Well, yeah, I thank you so much for your time and sharing your journey and your stories with us today. And can't thank you enough. Now would be the time for shameless self-promotion. So if there's anything that you wanted to bring up that we hadn't talked about, now is your time to let that out. And then we'll close for today.
Okay. Nothing really to self-promote or anything. Thanks for getting a hold of me. You know, and setting it up. Thanks for all your work for doing the podcast, because anybody that listens to us, or hopefully they get something out of it, probably just more on the historical side. You know, time is moving very fast. Like I said, some people, they don't even know who Ed Parker is, or they don't even want to know. It's like, dude, he's dead. Let's just move on. It's like, wow, that's not going to happen here. But, you know, I think guys like yourself that have these things are, you know, really important. So hopefully the guests you have, keep asking those questions, you know, bring those questions out. So, you know, the speakers have a chance to give you their insight on Ed Parker and Kempo and, you know, where it's going to go and where they think it's going to go. But, you know, it's a pleasure. Pleasure to meet you. Hopefully we chat again. And
oh, yeah, for I'll sure. We're going to have to have you back on for some of those Elvis stories. I certainly would like to hear about that. So, we'll definitely be in touch and once again, I thank you for being on and we will talk again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Reg.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkempo.com. Thank you.